This is MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell with Lori Ehrlich, the state representative representing Swampscott, Marblehead, and a piece of Lynn. And not an insignificant piece of Lynn, but a piece of Lynn.
A very important piece of Lynn. Thank you.
And for this discussion, the most important piece of Lynn, for sure, that you represent as a state rep. Well, the latest news with you, Representative, is that you are now a chairman and chairman of the Joint Committee on Export Development. So tell us about how that happened and what the committee does.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. And wonderful to be here. Hello out there. Nice to sit down and chat with you again. Yeah. It's great to have this opportunity to update you and everybody else. Yeah. That committee assignment is new on several levels. It's new for me. It's the first time I've been a chairperson. I just celebrated my ninth year as a state rep. So I'm honored to have the confidence of the speaker that he appointed me to chair a committee. But this committee also is new. It's a brand new committee. It's a joint committee, so it's House and Senate. And it has more of an outward-looking focus than a typical legislative committee. So we're going to be looking at what our state exports to other states and other countries. So come to find out, I did not know this. I did not expect to be assigned to this committee, so I'm learning as I go. This is very new. We have about $25 billion worth of exports in Massachusetts going to other places. I mean, that is a very significant piece of our economy. And that does not include services, which some feel is just about the same number. So it's a part of our economy that in the past has not really had a legislative focus. So it's sort of fresh turf. It's fresh turf for us legislatively. It's also a great opportunity for growth. Our export numbers have been flat for a lot of years, and there's a lot of potential. What some people may have seen in the Boston Globe, something I didn't know until I actually read it in the Boston Globe, apparently Bob Kraft had something to do with suggesting that this committee get set up and be in force. And I think it has less to do with the Patriots, more to do with his business. I guess he owns a paper business. But I look forward to working with him and anybody else in this space that exports.
And Tom Brady, if he wants to work with you, you work with him, right?
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
Well, so it's a big change in a sense that in the past you would have been a member of, I'm guessing, four committees, maybe three or four committees, correct? And being trying to be active on all those committees with different, you know, some are more demanding than others, I imagine, or that's how it's been explained to me in the past. So this is a clear, clean focus that you're just on the one committee as chair of that committee.
Yeah, that's correct. Typically a vice chair. I've been a vice chair for three of the past sessions. So my first two sessions as a vice chair, I had a lot of other committees. Last session, I was vice chair of healthcare financing, which is an incredibly work-intensive committee, obviously a very complicated and current issue there's a lot of focus on that. So I did not have any other committees assigned to me. So I was just focused on healthcare financing. Now, yes, it's true. This will be my only focus. And we are ramping up. There's so much wonderful energy among the other members of the committee. My co-chair is Eileen Donahue of Lowell. She's on the Senate side, and we're working together. And we're going to see where we can take this.
All right. So again, $25 billion of exports out of across state lines, across international lines, so to speak, as well. And I guess a couple of fair questions. What are our biggest exports from the state?
That's a great question. And these are a lot of the questions that I had to ask just recently.
So I'm a few months behind you. That's all. I don't think that's fair assessment of me. I'm sorry.
No. Not even a few months. This is a brand new assignment. Okay. So apparently we export a lot of medical devices, seafood, cranberries. I mean, there are some obvious things, and then there are some less obvious things. So manufacturing, I know I will. I've already been in touch with General Electric, which I think will have great interest in Lynn, because it's the major employer in the city. Jet engines are sold, obviously, to other countries. So there will be a tremendous manufacturing component to this committee. Also, in the legislature, you should know that there is an economic development committee, which is not that different than my committee, except my committee will have strict focus on export. The economic development takes on sort of a more of a within the state borders, developing our own state economy. Yeah. So, we'll see where it goes. But right now, it is a big space. There are state agencies that actually exist to aid in making sure that our export economy is strong. So I've already connected with them and other countries. I've heard from many consulates in Massachusetts. We have dozens of consulates set up in Boston. So I'll be connecting with them and finding out how we can assist in what they're doing.
So this clearly looks like be kind of a public-private kind of partnership, obviously, to kind of help increase exports. So, for example, how does that work then this may be a poor example, but GE would seem to be tied into businesses in other countries that would need jet engines, airplane manufacturers or whatever, and I guess those would be the primary buyers of airplane engines, jet engines. But as you point out, that I'm sure that GE also can facilitate a lot of that themselves. But I'm not sure, are there things that the state can do within the state to help out?
We're going to find out. But right now, the way I see it is, yes, you're correct. So GE will have a lot of those relationships established. Looking above a level from the state, there's a lot of conversation on the federal level of being perhaps a little bit more, not a little bit more, a lot more protectionist as a nation, which may mean tariffs, it may mean export restrictions, import restrictions. Other countries, how they respond will impact export trade. So there may be an opportunity to say, hey, we have a thriving export economy here. Please don't be so restrictive, or don't hurt our state's economy with these federal policies. Obviously, we will need to comply, or the businesses in Massachusetts will need to comply with federal policy. But there are ways we'll be able to help. I know there's talk on the federal level of the Export-Import Bank being completely eliminated, and that's a resource for companies to borrow to be able to export. So if that happens, there's a smaller source of a smaller resource on the state level. We may have to fill in some of the gaps left by changes in federal policy. So we're new, so we're nimble. So we're going to have to part of it is going to be trying to figure out how we can be helpful as we get to know, what's going on here.
Right. And I would imagine then the other public partnership is that you have connections to Washington and to to Congressman Moulton and our senators from the state as well. So it's very interesting. And you're right about the trade piece. I mean, that's what the president ran on is trade deals. And sometimes, there's a flip both two sides of this of a coin, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. And so that's now here's my other last question maybe on this, on the committee. Was this replicated from, say, any other state that would do something like that? And if so, how have they found this piece out, worked on this piece?
We are pioneers in this field. So there is not, as far as I know, there is not a single state in the country that has this committee. So I'm sure we will have the eyes of other states upon us. I've already met with Jay Ash, who is secretary under Charlie Baker in the economic development area. So we will be looking to work with the governor on growing this field, working together to promote Massachusetts as, great place to do business, but also a very friendly state to export from, and see how we can be helpful to those who do. So, yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Well, we're talking with State Representative Laura Ehrlich and Representative some environmental legislation, health legislation has been a part of what your career has been about. And I know you also have a bill in the legislature on drinking water. So maybe give us an update on that regarding lead in drinking water.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, I'm happy to discuss this. It's a brand new bill. And I'm just going to pick up this piece of paper, which you probably heard, and read you the bill number just so everybody has it. It's House Bill 2915, filed by me, and Senate Bill 456, filed by Senator Joan Lovely of Salem. And the name of the bill is An Act Ensuring Safe Drinking Water at Schools and Early Childhood Programs. And what that does, the purpose of the bill, in the most basic sense, is to get the lead out of drinking water at schools and daycare centers. There's a lot of awareness with lead because of decades worth of work done on, you know, lead paint and lead pipes, and people know that lead is toxic. Lead is a neurotoxin, and it's been found to affect a young or developing brain much more so than an adult brain. So clearly we don't want our children drinking it. It's out of paint now, so the awareness brought about a good change, so we don't have to worry about lead in paint anymore. But when you send your child to school, you don't want them drinking it because it's incredibly toxic. So the state of Massachusetts implemented a program where schools could step up voluntarily and the state would pay to have their drinking water tested. That program was last session, and the results are coming in, and we're finding that almost, I think it's close to half of all of the tests are coming back with lead in them. So I think they did 6,000 tests, and more than slightly less than half of them are coming back with lead. So clearly we have an issue. And there's great awareness across the state where the lead tests came back high. People don't want their children drinking this lead. So you say, well, what should we do? What do we do about this? Well, this bill lays out very specific things that need to be done if a test comes back positive. And that involves a few things. First of all, the utility has to let the school know if they have what's called a lead service line. And lead service lines were put in decades ago, and when lead was not known to be hazardous. And they're all over Massachusetts. So a lot of people, if you have a school, you don't know what the service line is made of. And what a service line is it's a narrow pipe that brings the water from the street into the school. So that's the easiest fix, is to just, you know, just once the school is notified that you have a lead service line, it's then on the utility to come in and replace the service line with something that's not lead. But they have to notify the school. If the school finds out that they have a lead service line and a positive test, then they have to filter the water until the lead service line is replaced and the water tests okay. There's also a requirement that if you have been captured by this program, that going on in the future, you have to continue to test the water once a year, just to make sure that it's not internal pipes. The question arises, what if it is internal pipes? What if all of the school is filled with lead pipes? What do we do? Well, in that case, the pipes have to be repaired. But there exists, if it's too much for the school district to replace pipes, there is a waiver that the commissioner of DEP can grant if there's a hardship. But ultimately, it comes down to, it just has to be done. This is not something, you don't want your children drinking lead. It has an impact on, you know, their entire future. There is no treatment to get lead out of your body. Once the damage is done, it's permanent damage. There is no way to, you can stop taking in lead, but the damage is done. So it becomes a permanent problem for these children.
Now, I would imagine you get a comment like I'm about to make to you here. It would be, is that I thought that we had already passed this problem, that this was not a problem, that we all know lead is bad, that we don't have lead paint anymore, we don't, you know, we know about lead pipes and so on, but that in schools that it would have been tested, and that we knew that it wasn't, you know, that people were not drinking lead water. And it makes, now I'm also thinking, what about homeowners and things like that? Are there, you know, how many homeowners are drinking, you know, kind of lead-tainted water, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I think people do think that the lead is out because the water, there's a very stringent testing protocol for drinking water. So when it leaves, you know, our water, at least in my district, is all MWRA. So yeah. It's coming from the Quabbin Reservoir. It travels here. There's testing protocols. It's okay. It doesn't have lead in it once it gets, you know, into the pipes. But while it travels, it can pick things up. So what's happening is it is picking up lead. If the test is positive, it's picking up lead in either the service line or in the school. Yeah. And all of that testing is for naught if the water arrives fine and then picks up lead right at the end of right. its travels. So this is sort of dealing with the end, the very right. end of the journey that the water makes. But it's the most important part of the journey because there's no opportunity to get the lead out. So you can filter lead out pretty easily. It actually does filter out. Okay. So if this is a concern, if you have a lead line at home, most people don't know if they have a lead line at home. I don't know if I have a lead line at home. So I think, you know, that's an opportunity for transparency. But yes, houses, just as schools, probably do have lead lines. But we thought because of the vulnerability of children's brains, developing brains, this was a good place to start. Schools, daycare centers, charter schools, all schools, to start there.
No, absolutely. Let's talk about some other legislation that you're involved with and working on. And this is a story that I remember reading about in the last month or so. Elephants and circus. In fact, mm-hmm. one of the circuses just closed, actually, wasn't right. it? And I don't know if they were citing part of this kind of legislation or not. But tell us about the elephants/circus bill that you have.
Okay. Well, I have two bills, actually, that deal with elephants, which I feel like they're my adopted creature at this point.
Now, I do remember the other one.
The other one deals with ivory, yeah. and we discussed that before, but it's sort of funny that I've adopted the Republican Party symbol, but both of my bills are completely, you know, bipartisan, bicameral. They have tons of support in the legislature. But today, let's focus on the circus bill, because I think this is an interesting journey this bill has taken in the legislature. For years past, I had co-sponsored a bill with my Senate colleague, Bob Hedlund from Weymouth, I believe. And he left the legislature and is now mayor there. And what that bill was it banned the use of bull hooks on elephants in circuses or in any environment. And what we heard for feedback, the bill came very close. It had a lot of co-sponsorship. People thankfully care about animals in the state legislature. But people said, well, if you take away the bull hooks, we can't safely control the elephants. And, you know, what are we going to do? So they said, this is just trying to get us to stop using elephants. And we're like, well, I guess that's not correct, but it's not wrong either, because we think, you know, maybe elephants don't belong in traveling circuses. So this time around, we refiled it and we just said, okay, yeah, you accused us of, you know, that's what we were trying to do. Let's just do it. Let's just not allow elephants in circuses. And along the way, right before I filed this, actually, Barnum & Bailey stepped up, and that's owned by Feld Entertainment, a Florida company. And they have been the most active lobbyists against the bullhook bill since I filed it for several sessions. And they stepped up and they said, you know what? Bowing to public pressure, activism, and for economic reasons as well, because people were not going to the circus because of this issue, we're going to stop using elephants in our circuses. Now, they are by far the largest under the circus tent, and they voluntarily did that, I applaud tremendously. But unfortunately, there's a lot of little circuses around where the elephants probably need more protection than they did under Felt, because they may not have the facilities or the funding or the backing, you know, that Barnum & Bailey did. So the elephants almost need more protection. So what this does is it doesn't allow elephants to be used in traveling circuses. So And the reason we're doing this is to really to protect the animals. To have them do tricks, it's fear of punishment that makes them do the tricks. It looks adorable when you see them, and yeah. I love elephants as much as any child, but it's because they're responding to pain, and the training process is not a positive reinforcement. It's very much a negative reinforcement. When they travel, they're standing still for miles and miles, sometimes for days at a time, and they're standing in their excrement, and they get infections in their feet, and it's the foot infections are actually the largest reason for euthanasia in elephants in captivity. So it's just not healthy for them, and it's really not fair. So one thing that I noticed, which I thought was fantastic, Barnum & Bailey is now advertising, now that they don't have, they're not using elephants, they have these extraordinary puppets. Puppet probably isn't the right word, but it's like in Lion King, they had those beautiful creatures that are, there are people in them, but they use wands to control the motions of the animal. They're doing that with elephants, not real elephants. They're people, but just to give the kids sort of the fantasy feel, just like in Lion King when that was in the theaters. So I think that's a great substitute. And there's always, you know, Cirque du Soleil, the Big Apple Circus, they don't use the animals either. I also want to just point out that my Senate colleague, and we have, I think, almost 100 co-sponsors in the legislature on the circus bill. My Senate colleague, Bruce Tarr, he's up in Gloucester, he filed a bill that bans all wild animals in circuses. So he went a step further. So we look forward to, I'd support that effort as well, and I look forward to working with him and others in this effort.
Well, as I listen to you, and I'm thinking, you know, really, circuses really have not changed in about 100 or 200 years. You know what I'm saying? I remember seeing a display at a museum. Clearly, this was a late 1800s kind of exhibit on a circus or their equipment they had. And I'm sure things haven't changed in probably 150 years.
Right. And I think that's probably true of Barnum & Bailey. They have quite a history of, you know, and then there's tradition as part of that, too. Yeah. So good on them. I mean, I've been on the opposite side, you know, filing a bill that they're against for a lot of years. But I am delighted to give them positive publicity, you know, for stepping up and doing the right thing before it was required of them. So good for them. On this issue, the state of California has already stepped up and done this, so we would be second. But there are many localities, including in Massachusetts, that have already stepped up and taken this action. So I look forward to bringing it statewide.
We can still buy animal crackers, though, right?
Yes. That's animal crackers are cool. Yes.
Okay. All right. I don't know why that vision crossed my brain here, but I think it's that little display, the box with the animals and the circus and the or whatever. They're not being mistreated, and I don't mean to make light of it. You know, I really don't. I'm sorry. Okay. Well, one other piece of legislation that you've been working on is regarding sexual assault on college campuses. Mm-hmm. So how about an update on that one?
Yeah, sure. This is an issue that's had a lot of awareness recently with some high-profile cases and some high-profile universities, but it is an issue that is increasingly a problem on college campuses. There's also this, which this bill doesn't cover, but I think it's interesting. It's such a problem that there's an entire adjudicatory process that has come up in, you know, college campuses now have to have almost like a separate court setting to adjudicate some of the sexual assault cases that are occurring on college campuses. These victims they have a college process and then also the criminal process through the courts, through law enforcement. So it's an issue, but a lot of times college campuses are motivated to sweep it under the rug because it makes them look bad. It's an incredibly competitive environment. They all want to outdo each other in statistics. I have two daughters on college campuses, so I know this. I know how sensitive they are to this. What this bill does is it requires, it's actually just a task force that would assemble with experts in law enforcement, in higher education, in like the rape crisis centers, and people in this area that will come together to decide what the best practice is for putting a survey out to the community to find out how safe people feel and how do they feel safe on campus. Is the school responding properly? Are you, you know, do you have suggestions on what we can do? Right now, many schools are stepping up and actually voluntarily doing these. MIT, is their survey is known as the gold standard. They stepped up and voluntarily did one of these and shared the results. I have a daughter at University of Chicago, and they took, I believe they took MIT's survey, and they enhanced it to add in, like, you know, what is the racial climate on campus, and do you feel safe, and you know, to give people a chance to respond. What they all did, with, and my other daughter's, she's at Syracuse, and they did this. They did a survey as well, and the schools share the information with the student body. Some schools even they include faculty in this process. So it's really an opportunity for feedback for the universities. But as a consumer, it allows parents or students to say, well, wait a minute, that campus might not have a safe. Might not be safe on that campus. Maybe I'll choose another school. So by doing a survey, the student is informed, the family is informed, and hopefully it can also be a baseline that school administrators can use to make the campus safer or improve on how they do things and focus on that. So it's an opportunity for focus. So the task force will be tasked with coming up with the best sort of a model survey. They can adapt it, but it'll be like a basic model survey, and then they have to administer that survey on a yearly basis to everybody on campus, all the students at least.
I think, too, that there was one of the news stories in the last month or two I heard was that college campuses is what you talked about earlier, is the way they handle a situation. So if, let's say I'm a victim. And if I'm at school X, it's handled one way. If I'm at school Y, it's handled a different way. You know, and you could make a case that one is much better than the other, and that you mentioned the internal kind of investigating piece or element there, is that there are some schools that might want to say, okay, we'll deal with this, and we won't go outside, which is probably a mistake, you know, and so, and then, you know, I don't think you can probably ever go wrong by going outside. That seems like the most open and transparent kind of reaction to this piece. But that piece, too, it seems to be huge, is that element needs to, you know, people need to be aware of that element. And through communication and openness, I think that would be healthy.
It, absolutely. And there is another bill that is trying to get a hold of what the best way to deal with those situations. There's another bill, and it's actually being heard in the same hearing as my bill.
Okay.
So if this is an area that people are concerned about or would like to testify, the hearing is on the 13th of April, and it's at 10 a.m., I believe. I'm not sure what room in the State House it is, but feel free to just go. You can reach out to me, and I will guide you if it's something that you're concerned about. But the what spending time talking about this issue, and this is the second session that I've worked on this issue, and also with children on college campuses of my own, what I've come to understand is that oftentimes if you find yourself as a victim, the best alternative is to pursue both courses of action. Go the legal, go the, you know, law enforcement route, and also pursue justice on campus. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, they you know, one is more successful than the other. It depends. It varies so much campus to campus as to what that process even looks like. But that they you don't have to choose one over the other. A lot of times there will be pressure on the victims to choose one or the other.
Yeah.
But you don't have to. You can pursue both. So I mean, it's a horrible situation. Campus campus assaults are particularly tricky because oftentimes it's a friend or somebody, you know, or there's a lot of alcohol involved, or you know, so they're tricky to deal with. So that's why, you know, the law enforcement and the process is very much an evolving thing right now.
Well, Representative Ehrlich, is there anything else you'd like to share with us? We've ticked off a bunch of topics here, but I guess any, you know, as we look out here, we're getting ready for spring, right?
Yeah, except I believe I saw snow. So hopefully this is our last day of snow until next winter. But no, I'm happy to chat with you. We covered a wide range of topics, and come back again and I'll update you on all of these things.
Absolutely. Sounds great. All right. That's Representative Lori Ehrlich with us, representing Marblehead, Swampscott, and a portion of Lynn as well. Here with us, I'm Bill Newell on MSONewsSports.com.